This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is the Washington Post for Saturday, the 18th of May. I'm Dave Abbott. The lead story, Biden and Trump cut a deal on debates. Then the fighting started. Inside the ongoing feud over who came out on top when two candidates decided to upend the nation's presidential debate tradition. This by Michael Shearer and Josh Dowsey. Less than 2 hours after President Biden made his move Wednesday to upend the nation's presidential debate tradition, two of CNN's top political journalists were on the phone with Donald Trump's high command. "We are sending you a proposal for a debate that will be in your inbox at 10 a.m., one of them told the Trump senior leadership, Susie Wiles, Chris La Civita, and Tony Fabrizio, in a call before rattling off the terms of a June 27th meeting in Atlanta, according to a person familiar with the conversation. By 10:14 a.m., Biden's campaign had announced the president would attend the CNN event. The Trump campaign agreed minutes later. One of the most consequential disruptions to the sequence of American presidential campaigns since the first televised debate in 1960 had been completed by lunchtime. The only thing left was for the campaigns and the country to figure out what had happened. Disagreements about the debate conditions and the agreement's significance flared even as voters began hearing the news. At 10:56 a.m., CNN announced terms that largely followed the demands Biden had announced earlier that morning, a first meeting in June, organized by a network on Biden's suggested list with no live audience. Biden had demanded a one-on-one debate with Trump, but CNN laid out criteria that allowed for other candidates to qualify. The network said all participating candidates had to meet a polling threshold and gain ballot access in a sufficient number of state ballots to reach the 270 electoral vote threshold to win the presidency by June 20th. Not only did that standard provide a path for independent candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to make the stage, but it appeared to exclude both Trump and Biden, who will not become their party's official nominees until later in the summer. Biden's advisors quickly let it be known that they had not agreed to any terms that could include Kennedy. One of the CNN producers on a Wednesday call with Trump aides had explained at the time that RFK will not be on the stage, the person familiar with the call said. CNN announced that both Biden and Trump had been invited despite the language requiring candidates to have ballot access. The confusion would only deepen in the coming days as Biden's campaign aides said they were celebrating their ability to get Trump to agree to their terms, and the Trump campaign said they were celebrating getting Biden to debate at all. Kennedy advisors quickly accelerated their plans to turn in ballot access signatures that had been holding at bay to prevent legal challenges, and they began to explore a lawsuit to force CNN to put them on stage. Then Trump released a social media post that said, "I don't care if Kennedy joins the debate." This reconstruction of the whirlwind 72-hour span that could shape the outcome of the 2024 election is based on interviews with 14 people familiar with the events as they unfolded, many of whom spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe private conversations. They described how the Trump and Biden campaigns, with the help of eager networks, had for once found a way to come together for two meetings, including a second debate by ABC News in September, even as animosity between the two camps remained high. At the center of their fight is the question of which campaign will benefit from the unprecedented reordering of the campaign season. Never before has a televised debate between major party presidential candidates occurred before the fall. General election debates have been carried live by all major networks for decades, but these two meetings will be produced by single outlets, which is likely to dramatically limit viewership. Trump and Biden long agreed that the first debate needed to take place before September 16th, when the Commission on Presidential Debates, for decades the arbiter of such meetings, had scheduled the event. Both parties had also grown impatient with the commission and thought they could negotiate directly, even communicating privately in recent weeks about ditching the commission structure. Frank Fahrenkopf, Jr., the co-chair of the commission, argued that Biden came out on top this week because Trump gave up his campaign's negotiating leverage by publicly saying he would meet Biden when and where the president wanted. He was still processing the Wednesday morning letter from Biden pulling out of the commission when he was notified that Trump had accepted the debate terms. "I couldn't believe it," he said. "Anytime in politics you get the other side to agree to what you want to do without any major changes, that's pretty good. But I guess when your candidate has gone out there and said, 'I'll debate you under any time, under any circumstances,' it kind of makes it hard for his people to fight back." La Civita said Fahrenkopf was a loser whose time had passed and that two-thirds of the Washington intelligentsia didn't think Joe Biden would ever debate. Biden's top advisors in Wilmington celebrated the rapid conclusion of negotiations as a clear win. They had been plotting for months to move the debates out of the commission's control, eliminate a live audience that Trump could use to his advantage, and move the debates earlier in the year as they seek to cast the election as binary choice between Biden and Trump. They believed Trump erred by expressing his public eagerness for debates and gave them a chance to control the situation. "He had no choice," Biden campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon said. "At the end of the day, we are always calculated and always disciplined. We always do what the president sets out to do." La Civita argued that what mattered was that Biden had agreed to appear at all on stage with Trump for two 90-minute meetings, which the Trump campaign had doubted would ever happen. An open invitation was issued by Donald Trump. The hook was baited with a juicy worm, and they took it hook, line, and sinker, La Civita said. "The fact is, there is now going to be a debate. Donald Trump will kick his ASS in a studio or in front of a group of people. It doesn't matter." Trump has told advisors in recent months that he is supremely confident that he can beat Biden in a debate and that Biden will look weak and old compared to him. He wanted to accept the proposals immediately. Top Trump officials were in New York on Thursday at CNN headquarters for a meeting about the debates and other topics. Four people familiar with the matter said. The Trump campaign and CNN declined to comment on the meeting. Some of Trump's advisors want to negotiate extensively with CNN in the coming weeks. They intend to continue pressing Biden to accept additional debates, a possibility that Biden's aides categorically reject. Some of Trump's advisors, however, privately think Biden will be better on the stage than he is at answering questions from reporters because he will be prepared and rested. The truth is, on debate night, you don't know which Biden you're going to get because he clearly has his good days and bad days, said Tim Murtaugh, the 2020 Trump campaign's communication director. I think you have to plan for awake Biden, but know that there's a chance you'll get sleepy Joe instead. The confusion over debate qualification rules has given hope to the Kennedy campaign, which has been seeking its own debate with the major party candidates. Under the old commission system, debates did not begin until after all state ballot access deadlines had passed, ensuring that debate organizers would know which candidates were on enough ballots to be eligible. The commission also averaged together polling from five firms to determine which candidate was polling over 15%. Kennedy has been polling well below 15% in recent polling averages, at 11 and 10%, according to two popular aggregators, but the CNN qualification required only four polls at or above 15% to make the stage, a much lower standard given the natural variation in individual polling results. Kennedy already has at least two polls that meet that standard. ABC News has adopted a similar standard for the September 10th debate, but the network has not yet disclosed the time period for those polls. Kennedy's campaign emailed CNN on Wednesday to make clear that they intended to make the June debate stage, followed by a Friday call with the network, according to a campaign official. His top aides have said they will definitely have submitted verified signatures in enough states to meet the 270 electoral vote threshold. The campaign is still trying to determine if enough states will have officially placed Kennedy on the ballot by June 20th. Kennedy's advisors have also begun speaking with lawyers about drafting a lawsuit against CNN based on the argument that CNN is obligated to treat all candidates equally. How many state ballots are Presidents Biden and Trump officially on yet? The answer is zero, pending their conventions. Kennedy campaign manager Amaryllis Fox Kennedy, who is his daughter-in-law, said in a statement, "We cannot anticipate whether some states will try to delay their own internal processing. But again, official appearance on the ballot cannot be the threshold, or else the major party candidates would qualify, or else neither of the major party candidates would qualify." Jed Rubenfeld, a law professor at Yale University who has been talking with the Kennedy campaign about its legal options, said there are federal regulations that require equal treatment of candidates and pre-established objective criteria for debates, even by cable networks without broadcast licenses. If CNN is going to apply a likelihood kind of criteria, then they would have to apply that even-handedly to all candidates, he said. I think the campaign will be looking at possible liability on CNN's part if it starts to play fast and loose with its criteria. CNN declined to comment on Rubenfeld's legal theory. La Civita dismissed the legal threats as spurious. "The notion that Biden and Trump are not the nominee yet is ludicrous," he said. "That's what unemployed lawyers talk about when they have nothing better to do." Biden's team is adamant that the debate issue is now settled. They have accepted a CBS News proposal for a vice presidential debate this summer, but other networks continue to try to propose alternative dates for Biden and Trump to meet. On Friday afternoon, Trump accepted a Fox News vice presidential debate and an NBC Telemundo debate in the fall. Biden advisors say the president will do exactly two debates. Fox News, they add, is not eligible in their initial proposal for a vice presidential debate because, like MSNBC, the network did not host both Republican debates in 2016 and Democratic debates in 2020. The Commission on Presidential Debates has decided to continue to plan for the traditional debates later this year, just in case the agreement between Trump and Biden does not last. I don't know if it will fall apart, Fahrenkopf said. We're hanging tough to see what happens. Next, second Russian invasion of Kharkiv caught Ukraine unprepared. Despite months of complaints from troops over shortages and fatigue, Kyiv has been slow to ramp up mobilization, leaving some areas of the front critically understaffed. This by Isabel Koshudian, Sergei Korolchuk, and Mary Ilushina. Russia's new offensive across Ukraine's northeastern border had been expected for months, yet it still surprised the Ukrainian soldiers stationed there to defend against it. Ukraine's 125th Territorial Defense Brigade stretched thin along a roughly 27-mile stretch of the Kharkiv region's border with Russia, used reconnaissance drones to monitor daily how Moscow was steadily building up forces for a possible attack. But the morning it happened, May 10th, the brigade lost all its video feeds due to Russian electronic jamming. Its Starlink devices, satellite internet, the Ukrainian military relies on for basic communication, failed the first time it was knocked out completely for them since Russia's invasion in February of 2022. We were left at a certain point completely blind, said a drone unit commander in the brigade. The post agreed to identify him by his call sign, Artist, in keeping with Ukrainian military protocol. This was the biggest problem. We didn't see how they were moving. We only worked through radio or through phones where they still worked, Artist, a 53-year-old sergeant, said. The drone feeds, he said, simply disappeared. Within days, the Russians had captured for the second time some 50 square miles of territory along the border, capitalizing on a moment of particular vulnerability for Ukraine's military. A U.S. aid package, including funding for precious ammunition for artillery and air defense, stalled in Congress for more than 6 months before it was approved last month, leaving forces on the front line often unable to fire back as their positions were pummeled. Meanwhile, despite military personnel complaining for months of personnel shortages and extreme fatigue among troops who have been fighting for more than 2 years, the government in Kyiv has been slow to ramp up mobilization, leaving some areas of the front critically understaffed. But Russia's battlefield gains in recent days were not only a result of Ukrainian shortfalls. Begrudgingly, Ukrainian troops admit that their enemy has gotten smarter and has adapted, especially with technological advancements such as electronic warfare. A sharp contrast with the first year of the invasion, when Russia's own blunders and overconfidence allowed the Ukrainians to hold key cities and later liberate large swaths of territory in successful counteroffensives. The new Russian advances in Kharkiv and in the neighboring Donetsk region have prompted questions about the viability of Ukraine's defense, not only if Kyiv can fulfill its promise of expelling all invaders, but also if Russia will soon overpower Ukraine's forces and seize more territory. The latest assault on the Kharkiv border has forced Ukraine to redirect some reserves north, potentially imperiling other positions. Even as they watched the Russians building up forces, Artist, the drone commander in the 125th Brigade, said the Ukrainians were largely unable to construct the kind of fortified defense lines now being emphasized by the government and by military commanders. The Russians' own layered web of dragon's teeth, anti-tank pyramid blocks, mines, and concrete-reinforced trenches proved effective against Ukraine's disappointing southeastern counteroffensive last summer. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky even visited the Kharkiv border in April to inspect the newly reinforced defenses, but artists and other soldiers said that every time the units stationed there tried to build fortified lines, the Russians, using their own reconnaissance drones, would monitor their activity and fire on them. Excavators and other engineering equipment were needed but not brought in because it would have been easily destroyed by the Russians. Especially with U.S. aid lagging, Ukrainian soldiers said they lacked the means to fire back and give themselves the time to build stronger defenses. The Ukrainians were also prohibited by the White House from using U.S.-provided weapons to strike Russia, despite the Russians firing at them from across the border. Artist said that soldiers in his unit would dig with shovels at night. "We tried to do what we could, but it's not the same," he said, "because the soil is very heavy here. It's machines that can dig through that, and machinery that can install concrete fortifications," he added. "We weren't able to do that. Ammunition, artillery could have protected us. People would have been able to work in those moments, but sadly we have wasted a lot. More than half a year has been wasted because we were not able to do this." Russia chose points of attack smartly, moving between rivers that could be used for natural cover. The assault on Voshchansk, a small city that Russian troops have already breached, could give Russia a lane to move toward Kupiansk, a city liberated by Ukrainian forces in September of 2022. A second flank of the attack toward the village of Lipetsi could put Moscow's forces in range to shell Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city. Nearly 8,000 civilians have been evacuated, a wave of displacement not seen since the early days of the invasion. The scale and goal of Russia's new offensive in Kharkiv remains murky, but experts say at this stage that capturing Kharkiv city is out of reach, partly because of Russia's own soldier shortages. Russia has ramped up recruitment of contract soldiers and significantly boosted sign-up bonuses for men willing to fight, up to nearly $10,000 in some regions, roughly 15 times more than the median salary. Russia has resourced this as a limited incursion for a buffer zone, rather than an attempt to occupy the entirety of Kharkiv all at once, said Dara Masikot, a senior fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. However, this may be phase one of a larger long-term plan. The buffer zone is intended to protect Russia's Belgorod region, which is adjacent to Kharkiv, from repeated Ukrainian strikes. It's one of the few areas in Russia where residents feel the persistent direct impact of a war that has destroyed Ukrainian cities and displaced millions. Speaking from China during a state visit on Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin himself said the operation was only to create buffer zone to protect Belgorod after repeated attacks on the city. As for Kharkiv, there are no such plans as of today. The Russian troops fighting in Kharkiv appear to be drawn from new units that were trained or regenerated from inside Russia, Masikot said, adding that Russia's priority remains capturing the Donetsk region. Notably, Moscow has not withdrawn forces from Donetsk to support the new offensive in Kharkiv, she said. Ukraine, however, had to send reinforcements from the Donetsk and Luhansk regions to repel the assaults in Kharkiv. one of the redirected brigades, the National Guards Kartia, now has units stationed on the border. Ukraine's military command has insisted that the situation in Kharkiv has stabilized, but in a post on social media on Thursday, Zelensky described it as extremely difficult. Kartia's commander, Colonel Ihor Obolyensky, said Russian troops attempted to storm his soldiers' positions 6 times on Wednesday. That's only on one side, he said. In a tactic similar to one Russian forces used to capture the Ukrainian city of Bakhmut last year, groups of infantry have attacked in waves, but the groups now have more than 15 soldiers, Obolyensky said, twice as many as in Bakhmut. Previously, they walked and stretched, 3 people each, and made small attacks. He said, now they are making big advances. 20 people each try to run in, try to throw grenades. The Russians also drop glide bombs, sometimes weighing 0.5 ton, every 15 to 20 minutes, said the commander of a reconnaissance unit in Kartia, whom the Post is identifying only by his call sign, Navigator. Unlike missiles, the bombs themselves cannot be intercepted by air defense once they're dropped from Russian aircraft. That's one reason Ukrainians have pleaded for F-16 fighters, which would be able to challenge the encroaching bombers. The frequent airstrikes mean Ukrainian forces must constantly change their positions by at least 1,000 feet, sometimes multiple times per day. If they're spotted, a bomb will surely follow. Navigator said that before a strike, a Russian drone with electronic warfare capabilities will fly over the area to disrupt communications. I think they're going to try to get as far as they can here until they're stopped, Navigator said. And if they get entrenched, then it will be with concrete fortifications. And from our experience, we know they are quite good at doing that. They very quickly build their defense lines, so we'll do everything we can to prevent them. Next, moving on to back to U.S. politics, upside-down flag flew at Justice Alito's house after a neighbor dispute. Supreme Court Justice says his wife, Martha Ann Alito, flew the flag as a symbol of protest after a dispute over political yard signs turned personal. This by Justin Juvenal and Anne E. Marimo. In the fraught weeks after the January 6, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Samuel A. Alito Jr. flew an upside-down American flag at their home following a dispute with a neighbor over anti-Trump yard signs, according to a statement from the justice and interviews with neighbors. The upside-down flag has long been used as a sign of distress as well as protest by liberals and conservatives. At the time, it had been embraced by supporters of the Stop the Steal movement, who falsely claimed the 2020 election had been stolen from Donald Trump. Some rioters displayed it when they stormed the Capitol to disrupt the formal certification of Joe Biden's victory. The flying of the flag at the justice's home, which was first reported Thursday by the New York Times, has prompted calls for Alito to recuse himself from a pair of high-profile January 6th-related cases that the court is set to rule on in coming weeks. Whether Trump has immunity for his efforts to remain in office after losing the 2020 election, and whether it was proper for the Justice Department to use an obstruction statute to charge more than 300 people who rioted that day. Neighbors and acquaintances of Martha Ann Alito said they have never heard her espouse election disinformation or support for the January 6th attack. But they also said the flag was displayed on the front lawn of the Alito's Fairfax County, Virginia home soon after a dispute that appeared to have political dimensions Neither of the Alitos responded to a request for comment through the court. I had no involvement whatsoever in the flying of the flag, the justice said in a statement to the Times. It was briefly placed by Mrs. Alito in response to a neighbor's use of objectionable and personally insulting language on yard signs. A woman who lives down the street from the Alitos, who, like other neighbors, spoke on the condition of anonymity to protect their privacy, said her adult daughter had brought home some signs from a protest and propped them up against her bushes in the front yard. Another neighbor, who said the signs appeared in late 2020, said that one had Trump's name on it with an expletive, and that the other carried a message along the lines of, "You are complicit." The house sits at the entrance to the quiet suburban cul-de-sac that the Alitos have called home for more than a decade. The neighbor who described the placards said they didn't mention the Supreme Court justice explicitly, but the wording of the latter one prompted some residents to wonder whether it was a dig aimed at Alito, a staunch conservative who has frequently sided with Trump's position in cases before the court. At the time, the Supreme Court was deciding whether to take emergency action on a case related to Trump's efforts to block Biden's victory, and passions were running high about the election and about January 6th. In an interview Friday, the mother of the woman with the signs said Martha Ann Alito was passing by her home one day and made comments to her daughter about them. A heated back and forth ensued, but the mother said she did not know what was said. The daughter, who does not live in the Washington area, did not respond to requests for comment. Alito told Fox News reporter Shannon Bream on Friday that the sign with the expletive was about 50 feet from a school bus stop. He said his wife spoke with the neighbors about the signs shortly after January 6th, but the conversation didn't go well, Fox reported Friday. The neighbors then put up a sign directly attacking his wife and blaming her for the January 6th riots, Alito alleged. He did not say what the sign said, according to the news station. Alito told Fox that someone living on the property got into an argument with his wife and called her a crude, derogatory word for women. He said his wife was distraught afterward and wanted to make a statement, so she hung the flag upside down. Alito said he couldn't tell his wife what to do, and the neighborhood has been very political. One neighbor interviewed by the Washington Post said she first noticed the upside-down flag in late January of 2021, and it remained up for 2 to 5 days. The neighbor said she never saw anyone raise the flag or lower it when it came down, and Martha Ann Alito never told her what message she was trying to send. The Times obtained a photo of the flag flying upside down January 17, 2021. The incident has once again plunged the Supreme Court into controversy. 2 years after revelations that Virginia Ginny Thomas, the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas, pressed Trump White House officials to overturn the 2020 election results and said the contest had been stolen, Clarence Thomas has refused subsequent requests from Democrats and experts on court ethics to recuse himself from January 6th related cases. Some Democratic politicians and court accountability groups made similar calls Friday for Alito to recuse, arguing that the upside-down flag at his house raised questions about his impartiality and created the appearance of bias. Alito must recuse himself from cases involving the 2020 election and former President Donald Trump, Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries said in a statement. Congress should immediately consider legislation to impose an ethical code of conduct on the runaway Supreme Court. Asked at the White House briefing whether the president believes Alito should recuse, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said that That is something for the court to decide. She emphasized that Biden believes the American flag is sacred and that we should be making sure that it is respected in that way. The federal recusal statute that applies to all judges and justices requires a justice to disqualify himself, requires him to disqualify himself in any proceeding in which his impartiality might reasonably be questioned, or where he has a personal bias or prejudice concerning a party. The court's new code of conduct, adopted in November in response to ethics controversies, separately prohibits justices from engaging in political activity and directs them to act at all times in a manner that promotes public confidence in the integrity and impartiality of the judiciary. Court employees are regularly reminded that they may not publicly support or oppose a partisan organization or candidate, including through the display of signs or bumper stickers or stating positions on social media, according to the court's Human Resources Manual. Rakim H.D. Brooks, president of the liberal advocacy group Alliance for Justice, and a former law clerk to Justice Brett M. Kavanaugh during his D.C. Circuit tenure, said in a statement Friday that it does not matter whether it was Alito or his wife who flew the flag on the couple's property, so long as the justice knew it was being flown and did nothing to stop it. Supreme Court justices are supposed to be the ultimate guardians of our Constitution, Brooks said in a statement that called on Alito to recuse from any case related to Trump or the January 6th attack. But Stephen Gillers, an expert in judicial ethics at New York University's law school, disagreed, noting that the test in the recusal statute is based on the perspective of a fair-minded person who has all the facts. I don't think such an objective observer would question Alito's impartiality based on this incident, Giller said in an email. I find it impossible to believe that Alito knew the flag was flying upside down, or if he did know, that he knew the relationship to stop the steal. I don't believe he would have allowed this to happen otherwise. Gillers added that while Alito's explanation for how it happened is hard to believe, it is more credible than the view that he knowingly chose to fly the flag upside down, knowing its political message. Next, Johnson says personal attacks at a committee meeting are not a good look. A House Oversight Committee meeting devolved into a partisan shouting match between members filled with personal attacks about intelligence and appearance by Megan Vasquez. House Speaker Mike Johnson chided lawmakers Friday for a meeting the night before that devolved into a partisan shouting match between committee members and included personal attacks about intelligence and appearance. Johnson told reporters that the incident was not a good look for Congress and that members need to treat one another with dignity and respect despite their political differences. The House Oversight Committee meeting on Thursday was supposed to be focused on a resolution over whether to recommend holding Attorney General Merrick Garland in contempt of Congress. Tensions escalated when Representative Jasmine Crockett questioned why Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene was airing assertions about the political motivations of a judge overseeing a criminal case involving former President Donald Trump. Do you know what we're here for? Do you know we're here about A.G. Garland? Crockett said during the rare evening session for the committee. I don't think you know what you're here for, Green responded. I think your fake eyelashes are messing up what you're reading. That's when things began to boil over, as Green, a political flamethrower, already on the outs with some in her own party, over her recently failed attempt to oust Johnson from leadership, and Democrats continued to fight. In his remarks to reporters, Johnson didn't go out of his way to defend Green. We need people on both sides of the aisle to just take the emotion out of it, Johnson said. We can have vigorous debate. That's what this institution is built upon. But we have to treat one another with dignity and respect. Asked if he was disappointed at the behavior of some of his members, Johnson answered, "We're going to maintain decorum." At Thursday evening's committee meeting, after Green's eyelashes comment, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez asked to strike Green's word from the record and make her apologize to Crockett, saying, "How dare you attack the physical appearance of another person?" "Are your feelings hurt?" Green responded in a mocking tone, later asking Ocasio-Cortez, "Why don't you debate me?" The New York Congresswoman responded, "It's pretty self-evident." "You don't have enough intelligence," Green told Ocasio-Cortez. Although Green agreed to have her words stricken from the record, she added, "You'll never get an apology out of me." House Oversight Committee Chair James Comer then ruled that the comments did not violate House rules against engaging in personalities during debate. Crockett, disputing Comer's ruling, asked, "I'm just curious, just to better understand your ruling. If someone on this committee then starts talking about somebody's bleach blonde, bad-built butch body, that would not be engaging in personalities, correct?" The meeting room erupted once again, with a Republican member of the committee telling Crockett to calm down. The incident at the committee meeting, which led to a 24-20 vote along party lines to recommend holding Garland in contempt, was denounced by some members and egged on by others. Representative Katie Porter, who sits next to Ocasio-Cortez in the committee, wrote, "Disagreement is part of democracy, but the hearing descended into outright name-calling and insults about Congress members' appearances. No American deserves this chaos in Congress." Representative Matt Gaetz, observing the chaos, wrote, "Looks like they're having a totally normal one over in oversight." Democratic National Committee Chair Jamie Harrison embraced Crockett's response to Green, sharing a GIF of someone taking out trash. "Crockett is the queen of the Oversight Committee's clapbacks. I know her arms are exhausted from the daily draggings," he wrote on X. Okay, getting down to business. If Red Lobster's butter-bathed ship is sinking, remember the shrimp. The casual sit-down seafood restaurant is shuttering restaurants and could be on the verge of bankruptcy. This by Emily Heil. They say the shrimp did it. Locations of Red Lobster all over the country have been closing down, with dozens shuttering their doors this week. The company is reportedly teetering on bankruptcy, and some analysts say the money the iconic chain lost on its endless shrimp deal, where diners unexpectedly gobbled up enough to put the company millions of dollars in the hole, was its death blow. Were the shrimp simply too irresistible, or were diners' appetites for shellfish, yes, but also for a dazzling bargain, just too cavernous? On a night this week when I arrive at a still-open location in suburban Suitland, Maryland, the shrimp is not all you could eat. Still, it is plentiful. The scampi swim in a little ceramic bathtub of pungent parsley-flecked butter and garlic. The butterflied breadcrumb-coated fried variety are crisp, ready to be dunked by the tail in ramekins of horseradish-spiked cocktail sauce. For $17, you can order two styles. They also come flavored with coconut flakes or Mexican street corn, dragon-spiced, skewered, and grilled, or blanketed in Alfredo sauce atop linguine. Sure, the little fellas might not be ocean fresh. They were probably frozen, like much of the seafood we eat. But they are pretty good, or at least the crowd seems to think so. With the smell of melted butter and the sound of Britney Spears' coo in the air, I find it hard to believe that this seafood party could end at any time, and that this location, with its view of full parking lots and Chevrolet dealerships stretching in two directions, could be the scene of what has played out at other locations around the country, with apologetic notes taped to the door and workers loading out furniture and equipment for auction. Here, barely 3 miles east of Washington, D.C., the margaritas are still beach bucket sized, and those pillowy, salty, cult favorite Cheddar Bay biscuits are flowing. A winking server promises an extra delivery to make up for a long wait. There's a couple on a date that seems to be going well. After the appetizers come, she moves over to sit next to him on the booth bench. His arm snakes around her back. A table of women have gathered for ladies' night dinner, and they order a round of many-hued margaritas. There's no way to clink these glasses in a toast. You have to lean over them to slurp from a straw, which they do. The bar is full. It's easy to see how the lure of endless shrimp, though, took a pinch out of Red Lobster's bottom line. On TikTok, people shared their epic evenings devouring hundreds of shrimp for only $20 after the chain made what had been a limited-time deal a permanent fixture. On Reddit, people gamed out how to get the most out of the special. They boasted of body counts in the hundreds, of getting shooed out by fed-up servers delivering successive plates of seafood with ever-louder thunks of platters. As the 1990s ads for the chain used to say, "Wow, that's a lot of shrimp." To Michael Kaufman, a former restaurant chain executive and Harvard Business School professor, the run on the endless shrimp offer was just another burden for the chain, which was already facing steep challenges from rising food and labor costs to lower traffic from consumers feeling pinched. It was the straw that broke the camel's back, he said. The company had been bitten in the past by an all-you-can-eat special gone awry. In 2003, it advertised a special on crab legs, and the resulting swarm lost the company so much money it prompted the departure of then-CEO Edna Morris. It's not quite time to write Red Lobster's obituary. Experts say the brand could very well emerge from this round of downsizing and even a bankruptcy with a significant national presence intact. And so we come not to bury the lobster, but to remember it. Which would, of course, include those TV spots, many diners' introduction to the chain. The commercials were pageants of lemon wedges being squeezed and splashing butter. So much butter. Many starred wholesome families digging into seafood feasts, but some of the most memorable were downright seductive, like this one from 1990. The restaurant's signature jingle, "Red Lobster for the Seafood Lover in You," played as a smoldering torch song, while the shrimp's butter bath burbled, "Scampi," the narrator practically purrs, "Red Lobster for the Seafood Lover in You." The ads were so distinctive that they were even spoofed in a 2017 short horror film starring Gilded Age stars Carrie Coon and Morgan Spector. In the 2022 period drama, they play husband and wife, but in this, she's a customer trapped in a 1990s Red Lobster commercial, and he's the menacing waiter. The film seems to have disappeared from streaming platforms, alas, but in bootlegged versions you can see that the means of violence includes melted butter. Throughout the decades, the chain has undergone various reinventions. In 2007, it dropped the tagline, "For the seafood lover in you," in favor of "Come see what's fresh today," as part of a shift to emphasize its fresh fish offerings instead of the fried dishes it had long been known for. In 2011, it completed a redesign that invoked the nautical aesthetic of Bar Harbor, Maine. Think signal flags, Adirondack chairs, maritime art. A move meant to echo its highlighting of the flavors of America. In 2018, it brought out smaller seafood tasting plates and dishes with global flavors. Of late, Red Lobster has indulged in some cringy youth-oriented marketing, including attempts in a TV ad to capitalize on the viral TikTok audio clip of gospel singer Shirley Caesar, in which the singer praises beans, greens, tomatoes, potatoes, you name it. The chain hired her to sing in similar cadence, the makeup of its lobster and shrimp promotion, tails, shrimp, waiters, potatoes. And inexplicably, in April, it introduced a playlist of AI-generated songs celebrating Cheddar Bay biscuits. Sample track, Cheddar Bay Bouncin' 2. For all that effort in recent years, the chain seemed to whiff on a gift from the marketing gods. No less a pop goddess than Beyoncé mentioned the chain in her hit 2016 single, Formation, the lyrics of which suggested that if her lover pleased Queen Bey, he would be rewarded with a visit to Red Lobster. It took the brand a full 8 hours of lifetime and social media time to respond. And when it did, the engagement it offered was, in the collective judgment of the internet, pretty lame. Behind the scenes, management moves and market forces are what put it in its tenuous spot, experts say. The chain was founded in Florida in 1968 by restaurant giant Bill Darden, and enjoyed a long stretch of growth, first under the umbrella of General Mills, which spun the chain off in 1995 under the new Darden Restaurants Company. For many people in landlocked towns, Red Lobster was an introduction to the exotic world of lobster tails, snow crab legs, and, of course, shrimp. But as its sister restaurant, Olive Garden, soared, Red Lobster faltered, and the restaurant group sold the seafood chain in 2014 to private equity firm Golden Gate Capital for $2.1 billion. Its supplier, Thai Union Group, eventually became its biggest shareholder. That structure probably encouraged executives to make all-you-can-eat shrimp a permanent menu item, observers say, but it could also have created broader problems. I'd be concerned that if you are a restaurant chain that is owned by a supplier, you may be constrained in your ability to get competitive pricing, Kaufman says. And Steven Zagor, a restaurant consultant and professor at Columbia Business School, says the ownership might not be as committed to the core of what Red Lobster does. They're not doing it to be in the restaurant business, he says. They're in it to make money. He says that as Red Lobster raised its menu prices, it became less of a deal for diners who have plenty of other choices, including the proliferating range of fast casual spots. They became too much a part of American wallpaper. And the problem might not be just Red Lobster's, but that of all casual sit-down restaurants. Menu prices in the category are up 20% since 2021, in the face of higher costs on everything from labor to napkins, and customers are starting to balk, according to data from researcher Technomic. Some are offering deals to lure them back in, such as Red Lobster's Endless Shrimp, which turned out to be the miscalculation on top of the cherry. The company underestimated not just how much people would eat, it overestimated how much other business it would drive, Those calculations, Kaufman says, just didn't square with what the consumer did. I can relate. In Suitland, the meal has ended and a server delivers containers for our leftovers. The shrimp from my seafood feast is long gone, and so are the lobster tails, and I decide not to toss in the tangle of crab legs I couldn't polish off. But those cheesy, addictive biscuits go directly into the box. After all, I don't know when I might have them again. And quickly, Paul Pelosi's attacker has been sentenced to 30 years in prison. A jury convicted David DePape in November 2023 on federal charges of trying to kidnap then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and assaulting Paul Pelosi because of his wife's work in Congress. This by Ozzy Paibara. David DePape, the man whose embrace of right-wing conspiracy theories led him to break into Nancy Pelosi's San Francisco home and bludgeon her 82-year-old husband, was sentenced Friday to 30 years in prison. Federal prosecutors had asked for a 40-year term, arguing that the attack constituted an act of terrorism. In a statement Friday before the sentencing, Aaron Bennett, a spokesman for the congresswoman, said the family could not be prouder of their pop and his tremendous courage in saving his own life on the night of the attack and in testifying in the case. Nancy Pelosi and her family will not be offering further comment on this matter at this time. In a letter sent to the federal judge before Friday's sentencing, Nancy and Paul Pelosi asked the court for a very long sentence. For DePape, CBS News reported. Paul Pelosi also detailed the lingering effects of the attack in the letter. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre condemned the attack during a daily press briefing Friday. There's absolutely no place for political violence in America, not at all, she said after the sentencing. As leaders, we owe it to everyone not to repeat dangerous conspiracy theories and speak out against violence and violent rhetoric. A jury convicted DePape in November 2023 on federal charges of trying to kidnap the then House Speaker and assaulting Paul Pelosi because of his wife's work in Congress. The unanimous verdict came at the end of a four-day trial in U.S. District Court in San Francisco. On October 28, 2022, police in San Francisco responded to a break-in at the Pelosi home and found DePape, who grabbed a hammer from Paul Pelosi and attacked him in front of police. The attack was captured on police body camera video. Paul Pelosi suffered two wounds to his head, including a skull fracture. Nancy Pelosi was not home at the time of the attack. The attack at the home of one of the country's highest elected officials came just days before the midterm elections and renewed worries about the threat of political violence in a deeply polarized country. For months, sleeping alone in my home was very difficult because I kept remembering the defendant breaking into my house, Paul Pelosi said in the statement to the court. The defendant severely damaged the nerves in my left hand. My forehand was degloved, exposing raw nerves and blood vessels. Surgeries and treatments mostly healed the skin, but underneath, I still feel pinched nerves in my left hand. This makes basic tasks like using buttons, cutlery, and simple tools more difficult. DePape, who was 43 at the time of the trial, admitted that he broke into the house intending to hold Nancy Pelosi hostage and break her kneecaps. He also said he bludgeoned Mr. Pelosi with a hammer after police arrived because his plan to end what he viewed as government corruption was unraveling. That's all my time for today. This is Dave Abbott. This has been The Washington Post. Thanks so much for listening, and for goodness sake, let's be careful out there.